Okay, I wanted to start with just something that's not related to what I'm going to talk about, but it's just a nice little exercise in textual criticism. It came up a couple times in Brian's talk. In the last couple of weeks, we talked about a couple instances where you can see in the text where you can suggest a correction, and where a letter might have fallen out or a word, and because a scribe, when he was transcribing the text, may have missed it, or a letter that looks like another letter was transposed over it, and these types of things, so that and how scholars have sometimes made those amendments, and so I just want to show an example of a clear example of how that can work sometimes. So this is from 2 Kings 19, 26 and 27. If you want to turn there. So I'm going to do it on the board and in Hebrew, and I'll write it out so you can see it. So just bear with me. This is just a little exercise, but so the verse says, "While their inhabitants, shorn of strength, are dismayed and confounded, and have become like plants of the field and like tender grass, like grass on the housetops." What do you have next, right there? Read what you have, anybody.
Which verse?
This is 26.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 2 Kings 19, verse 26 and 27. But it's right at the end of 26.
Like grass growing on the roof, scorched before it grows.
Scorched before it grows. What? Anybody else have anything else?
Or rain scorched by the east wind.
Blinded. Scorched by the east wind, you have?
Yes.
Okay, that's interesting. What do you have?
Blinded before it grows.
Blinded before it grows.
It is grown.
Okay. What do you have in Arabic?
Kamal fuh qabla numuhi.
Qabla numu. Okay.
Before it grows, you know.
Yeah. Kan nafuh?
Kamal fuh.
Kamal fuh. Okay. Burned like almost, right?
Which means that before it becomes green and, you know, fruit.
Before it's ripe.
It's dried.
Right.
Here it says when they were like grass in a field or weeds growing on a roof, when the hot east wind blasts them.
Ah, okay. You have hot east wind. Okay. So this is what is there. This is what is here in the Hebrew. Okay. And my handwriting is terrible in any language, but so just to bear with me. This is chatsir. Chatsir gagot. That's like grass on the rooftops, okay? And then you have so that shdefa is this blighted, and then lifnei is before, and kama means rise. So that's right. How you have this.
Right.
Yeah. Sorry?
The last kama, you said it was rise.
Right. So it's kind of an odd wording, and translators didn't know what to do with it. And then, to make things more complicated, the next verse is also a little bit odd, because then you have. Go ahead and read the next verse in English, somebody.
But I know where you stay, and when you come and go, and how you rage against me.
Right. So, you know, in Hebrew, this is a poem right here. A third of the Old Testament is poetry, and Hebrew poetry is very, very often in couplets, and. One of the legs of one of the couplets is missing. So here's Veshivtecha, and then here's Metzeet Cha Vo'acha. And then you have Yadati. So Veshivtecha Vetzeecha Vocha Yadati. So you're sitting, you're going, you're coming, I knew. Okay? So a lot of translators didn't know what to do with this blighted before rising kind of odd wording. So Wellhausen, who's kind of, he's a German scholar, who's kind of this, the father of German textual criticism in many ways, he noticed that this Shdefa always appears together with Kadim, which is this easterly wind. So you have your translations, both of yours mentioned this easterly wind, but none of the Masoretic text has easterly wind in it. But in every other instance in the Bible, it always appears with easterly wind. So you have, like in Genesis, you know the story of Pharaoh having the dream of the seven fat cows and the seven skinny cows, and then the seven empty ears of wheat, and so the seven empty ears blighted by the east wind, and so then you have 7 years of famine, 7 years of famine, sorry, and then you have the seven, you know, nice plump ears of wheat, and you have 7 years of plenty. So there you have it several times, and there's this shdefa, these ears that are always, that always appears with this kadim, this easterly wind. So he Wellhausen assumed that somewhere in the transcribing of the text that kadim, there must have been a kadim right here. Alright? Kadim. It just was right here. And it just, when he was transcribing, how many times have you transcribed and just left a word or left a whole sentence out when you're like, when you're trying to copy something, you're just, your eyes just skip over a word because kuf, it's the same letter, so he was expecting a kuf, and then, but he looked straight to that kuf and then wrote that one. Can you see how that can happen sometimes when you're expecting to, you know, he knows he's waiting, he's anticipating this letter kuf, and so his eyes go to look for it, but he skipped over that word and wrote that one. So then that got written into the text, and then this one fell out. And so Wellhausen suggested that fell out, and then that also solves the next verse, because if you restore this word,
back around to over here, you have what he thought is you have kumcha, right? Kumcha. So that hay is actually the yukaf sofi. Kumcha v'shipecha. Tzeitcha u'boecha. In your rising and in your sitting. In your going and in your coming, I knew. So that way you have the two legs of the couplet restored. Because right now in the English you have this in your sitting and your going and your coming. You have this three thing that breaks up the poetry, and it's kind of an awkward phrasing. So it's a nice little correction that makes sense. It makes a lot of sense. And Brian made the point that whenever dealing with the text, you want to do this as little as possible. You want to try to find a harmonious way to interpret the text as it is without trying to put in text or take out text and try to leave the text in the form that it is without suggesting that there were mistakes or things that might have happened to it. But this one seems like something that's really clear, and it's a very common mistake that happens in transcribing. Wellhausen was born in mid-1800s, died in 1911. He made this suggestion towards the end of the 1800s. The cool thing about this, what he suggested about this word is that he suggested that this would be, instead of shdefa, that it was nishdaf, which is the passive form of blighted or scorched. So the cool thing about this is that 60 years later, the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered, and what was found was exactly this. He suggested shdufa. But the Dead Sea Scrolls were found, and it was nishdaf. Lifnei kadim, kumcha v'shitecha tzeitcha u'boecha.
So they had the two words. They had kadim.
Yeah, and it had kadim. They found it with kadim. So, and the Dead Sea Scrolls are the oldest text that exist. So, he never got to see that his suggestion, that his intuition was right.
It was vindicated.
Yeah, it was vindicated.
What does it say in the Septuagint?
It doesn't have it. It's also the Masoretic text. So it's just anyway, that was just an example of there is no one text that has when scholars come to do translations, they have lots of texts in front of them, and some of them are better in some cases than other, and they're picking and choosing which ones are best. There are corrections that you can make here and there, and I think there were humans that were working with these texts, and we can you know, I think we can trust God that he can show himself through his text, that, you know, he is God. We don't have to be afraid to protect his text, that if something happens to it, that somehow God will be hurt. And, you know, God gave us minds to use, and it's just, anyway, I thought that was just a neat example of how that type of intuition and that type of textual criticism works. So anyway, that wasn't what I was going to talk about. I want to talk about how we sometimes project modern concepts or concepts that we have today onto the Bible or onto the concepts that existed at the time that the text was written. A common modern concept that we have, or it's not even so modern, but it's a Greek concept. Even it's an old concept, but it's Greek, and it's not so much a Hebraic concept. And that's this dichotomy between mind and heart. You know, the Greeks made that dichotomy. You know, when we say, you know, don't let your emotions get in the way of logic. You know, that somehow, you know, everything that's logical and methodical and that's sort of mathematically clear takes place up here, and everything that's sort of mushy and gushy and not logical and not measurable and not confinable takes place here, and somehow, you know, here in your heart, I mean, and, you know, you have to make sure that this up here in your mind keeps this down here in your heart in check. And, but of course, if you only use your mind and don't use your heart, then you become this cold and only calculating person, and without feeling, and you can become a brutal person, and you know, there's this, we do this, right? We make this kind of dichotomy that there are these almost as if we have these two different engines in our system, these two machines in our body that are operating at the same time, and they're almost sometimes operating at odds with each other. You know, our mind versus our heart, and that we're being pulled in two different directions sometimes. I think sometimes, you know, we've been brought up to think that way, that you know, that those are the facilities that we have. And it comes across in the text sometimes when we read the Bible. I'll just give, you know, an example in Proverbs 22 verse 17, for example. Incline your ear and hear the words of the wise, and apply your what do you have there? Proverbs 22, verse 17. Incline your ear and hear the words of the wise. Apply your
heart.
Everyone has heart. I have heart too. To my knowledge, it could just as easily be mind. In the day that this was written, they probably just would have as easily said, "Look, I think what you need to do I think you need to go into battle right now and take 50,000 men with you, you know, as opposed to this." Actually, there wasn't even a concept that the thought process took place up here. It was all this. When you think about that, when you think about every time that the Bible mentions heart and it having that concept of it being your mind as well, it can sometimes change the way we think about what God is asking us to do, or what that Bible verse is telling us to do. Because
didn't it sometimes say kliot v'lev, kidneys and
right? That's a good point. That's a good point too. That sort of your whole being. I mean, that's another one. In the Shema that we read, for love of the Lord your God, how's it go?
Heart, soul, and mind.
Heart, soul, and mind. So, with all your heart, you could translate it with all your heart and mind, with all your emotions and thinking and your with all your that capacity. And nafshecha is another concept that we project. Soul, nefesh, in modern Hebrew translates as soul, but nefesh in biblical Hebrew is just person. It's with all of your person. It's with all of you as you. And it actually is retained in the Arabic, nafs. Nafs is just you. Is nafsak.
Nafsak is your whole body.
Your whole body.
Your whole being.
Your whole being, exactly. So it's retained in the Arabic, that meaning of just, it's just you. And me'odecha is your wholeness, your everything.
When they counted the people who went to Egypt, say 77 souls.
Right.
And Paul in the ship was with 276 whatever souls.
Right.
Souls means Paul.
People.
People.
Yeah, they're not exactly counting 70,000 floating spirits out there. It's counting people. Yeah. And it's interesting that modern science today too, I was shocked when I was a few years ago. I was taking these pills for my migraine, and I was addicted to them, and I had to go to the hospital to detox off these pills, and because I couldn't do it on my own. I tried to do it by myself, and I was just climbing the walls because it was just so painful. So I was hospitalized for 3 days, and I was put on a different type of medication that would sort of assist me to get off these migraine pills. And this medicine that I was being given through transfusion, it's called?
Intravenously.
Had the rare effect in some people that would just, it gave me this massive anxiety attack, and I just it just, I mean, they put it in, I felt it go through me, and just instantly, I just suddenly, I wanted to just rip it out of my arm. I wanted to jump out the window. I wanted to end my life. I was just going crazy. And the crazy thing was that I knew that this was not logical. I knew that this was just totally crazy. And Eva was with me. And I don't know what's going on with me. This is nuts. But the feeling was just so visceral and so real. And, I said, I gotta walk around or something. So we started walking around the kind of hospital. And then after about an hour, it started to wear off. And then it went away. And I thought that I just had some kind of weird panic attack about the thought of being in the hospital for 3 days and hooked up to wires and stuff that, I thought, wow, I didn't know I was claustrophobic and maybe I'm just having some weird panic attack. And so I thought, isn't that weird? But Eva, can you just please stay? Because I didn't know I had this in me, but obviously this is triggering something in me that I didn't know I had. But then I had to be administered this medicine every few hours. And then, sure enough, 6 hours later, when they came and did it again, boom, again, I wanted to jump out the window again. And it was just, and so Eva ran and told the doctor what was going on. And he said, oh, okay, so he's having that. Yeah, and some people, this has this. And so it does that to some people. So I'll give you a different medicine. So he did. He gave me something to counteract that. Anxiety went away. And then, I was fine. But, and so the doctor explained to me that basically, you have a certain chemical makeup that when you're given these chemicals, it sets off this chemical reaction that sends messages to your brain that creates a certain emotion. So the thought that just certain emotions can be set off, by chemicals, and that's all taking place up here. It just gave me a newfound sympathy for people who go through depression. I think I was really not sympathetic to people who go through depression. I think I was just much more skeptical, and why can't these people just get over it? And they're obviously, they're not dealing with something that's petty or, and it just made me realize that we're complicated beings, and you can't just be dismissive of a very complex set of factors that can set off different emotions and thoughts, and you can't make these simplistic dichotomies between thoughts and emotions and our mind versus heart, and stop feeling that way. Don't you understand the logic of what's going on here? I think guys have that problem, have that tendency more so than women, but but it's certainly not in the Bible. I think the Bible, you don't find that dichotomy at all. I think in the Bible you see a much more holistic approach to us as humans, that we are complex beings. And so when the Bible says, "Incline your ear and hear the words of the Lord," apply velibcha tashit ledati. Libcha, that's your mind, your heart. It's all of that. It's not we're not to make that dichotomy. Okay. So there's that soul. That's one concept that we project. There's heart and mind concept that we project. There's another concept that we, I think sometimes we project, and there's the issue of life and death. And I think we oftentimes also apply a very sort of clinical concept of life and death. We struggle with it in legal forms today. You know, people are on life support for years in hospitals, and what do we do with those people? Are they alive or are they dead?
Ariel Sharon.
Yeah, Ariel Sharon. Is he alive? Is he dead?
Well, he's not prime minister.
Well, yeah, they figured that out at least. And forgive me for those of you who've heard me harp on this argument before. Brian probably heard it, but in the Bible, I think you see a different concept of life and death completely. I think, you know, I wrote here, we tend to think clinically regarding life and death instead of fullness of life and all that entails. But in the Bible, you see this concept of on the one hand, laziness, wickedness. Laziness, inactivity, wickedness, being very close to death. Wicked people, lazy people, sluggards, slothness, are always associated with being close to death. And people who are active and righteous and vibrant are people who are always associated with being full of life. And so over here you have this laziness, even sleep. Sleep is oftentimes associated with being near death, a state of death. So let me just throw out you a ton of verses just to solidify that.
But the loose woman, she's dead while she liveth.
Oh, that's a good one. Yeah.
I met one this week. It was really, really sad. She shared with me that she was an escort girl in her prime.
Really?
And she was just emotionally dead.
Wow.
And it was so sad.
Huh.
And just shared a little bit. Thanks, God. Not enough. She is a little emotionally not there.
Wow.
Psychologically, but she said she was an escort girl for years.
Wow.
Just, and she's, she said she was 55, but she looked like she was 65, 70.
Interesting.
It was just very sad.
Yeah, it's tragic. Where's that verse, Dan?
Right here.
Mm-hmm. Well, while you're looking it up.
1 Timothy 5:6.
1 Timothy 5:6. Okay. So here's a concept of laziness being associated with death. Proverbs 18:9. If someone wants to look that up and read that, the next person can start looking this up already. Proverbs 22:13, and read that. I'm going to throw this verse out for someone else to look up so they can read it when we get there. 1 Kings 2:10. Another person can look up Psalms 13. I'll look that one up. Okay, so who has Proverbs 18:9?
I can take that one.
Go for it.
One who is slack in his work is brother to one who destroys.
I mean, that's pretty powerful stuff. I don't know if I've ever heard someone say that. Like, He who is slothful in his work is a brother to him who is a great destroyer, is the English that I have. I'll just read the... I mean, the Hebrew is pretty strong too. Adam chasar lev tokea kaf, orev aruba lifnei ra'eu. No, it's wrong in verse I was reading. Oh yeah. גם מתרפא במלאכתו אך הוא לבעל משחית. I mean, you don't usually think of like laziness. And so he's a brother of a great destroyer. Like, that's a pretty strong association, just to associate someone who's absolutely destructive with laziness. But that's how it sees it. Proverbs 22:13.
Could it be 19 also? 22:13.
Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah. Okay.
Lazy people stay at home. They say a lion might get them if they go outside.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Also, I found 19:13. A foolish son is destruction to his father. I don't know what I was looking
at. A foolish man? Mm-hmm.
A foolish son is destruction.
Yeah, so that, you know, again, that the lazy man says there's a lion outside, I'll be slain in the streets. Basically saying, you know, a lazy man sits around and doesn't see destruction coming, basically. Doesn't do anything about it. Knows it's coming. And is wiped away by it. It's your laziness brings you to the doorstep of destruction and death and everything that's associated with it. Here's a couple example of sleep being associated with death. Here's an obvious one, 1 Kings 2:10. Whoever's got that one?
First Timothy
5:6. 1 Kings 2:10 is, and David slept with his fathers, right? So there's, every king has that verse, right? When he dies, he sleeps. There's also that verse in the New Testament. Remember when Jesus, he rises and it talks about all those saints who rise from the dead. It talks about them, some of the saints who were sleeping are woken up.
Or Lazarus, when he said he's sleeping. They said, well, if he's asleep, well, they'll wake him up.
Right.
He said, he's dead.
Right. Here's Psalm 13, 1 through 3. How long, Lord, will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? How long shall I take counsel my soul, having sorrow in my heart daily? How long will my enemy be exalted over me? Consider and hear me, O Lord my God, enlighten my eyes, lest I sleep the sleep of death. Pen eshan hamavet. Again, this sort of sleep being associated with death. Psalm 76, 5-6. The stout-hearted were stripped of their spoil. They sank into sleep. All the men of war were unable to use their hands. At your rebuke, O God of Jacob, both rider and horse were cast into a deep sleep. Here's some verses, again, associating laziness, sleep, and death. Laziness, Proverbs 19:15. Laziness casts one into a deep sleep, and an idle person will suffer hunger. Proverbs 24:30-34. I'll just turn that real quick.
But he who keeps the command keeps his soul.
What's that?
A continuation of 19:15-16.
Oh.
But I mean, it fits very, very well with your argument, because laziness casts into each leaf, and an idle man will suffer hunger.
Right.
But he who keeps the commandment keeps his soul. But he who is careless of conduct will die.
Right. Mm-hmm. So, 24:30-34. I went by the field of the lazy man, and by the vineyard of the man devoid of understanding. And there it was, all overgrown with thorns. Its surface was covered with nettles. Its stone wall was broken down. When I saw it, I considered it well. I looked on it and received instruction. A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest. So shall your poverty come like a prowler, and your need like an armed man. Again, you know, it's not this like, you know, look, you know, if today we think of lazy people, lazy, you know, he's just a lazy guy, you know. The Bible says, you're lazy and you will be destroyed. Like, it's not just like, you know, he's lazy and so he doesn't really get much done, you know. You're lazy and you're close to death. Proverbs 6:9-11, there's, how long will you slumber, O sluggard? When will you rise from your sleep? And again, there's, like a prowler. Proverbs 10:1-5, real quick. A wise son makes a glad father, but a foolish son is the grief of his mother. Here, treasures of wickedness profit nothing, but righteousness delivers from death. So, this is interesting, because treasures of wickedness profit nothing. So it's not talking about prosperity gospel here. It's not talking about necessarily that. This isn't just juxtaposing monetary, physical money, because the wicked can have money, but that's not what's going to profit you. The Lord will not allow the righteous soul to famish, but he casts away the desire of the wicked. He who has a slack hand becomes poor, but the hand of the diligent makes rich. He who gathers in summer is a wise son, but he who sleeps in harvest is a son who causes shame. And so then here's one more, and this is Jesus this time, and it's a parable that is always difficult to preach from. It's in Matthew 25, verse 14-30. For the kingdom of heaven is like a man traveling to a far country, who called his own servants and delivered his goods to them. And to one he gave 5 talents, to another 2, and to another 1, to each according to his own ability. And immediately he went on a journey. Then he who had received the 5 talents went and traded with them and made another 5 talents. And likewise, he who had received 2 gained 2 more, but he who had received 1 went and dug into the ground and hid his Lord's money. After a long time, the Lord of those servants came and settled accounts with him. So he who had received 5 talents came and brought 5 other talents, saying, Lord, you delivered to me 5 talents. Look, I have gained 5 more talents besides them. The Lord said to him, well done, good and faithful servant. You were faithful over a few things. I will make you ruler over many things. Enter into the joy of your Lord. He also, who had received 2 talents, came and said, Lord, you delivered to me 2 talents. Look, I have gained 2 more talents besides them. His Lord said to him, well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful over a few things. I will make you ruler over many things. Enter into the joy of the Lord. Then he who had received the one talent came and said, Lord, I knew you to be a hard man, reaping where you have not sown, and gathering where you have not scattered seed. And I was afraid, and went and hid your talent in the ground. Look, there you have what is yours. But his Lord answered and said to him, you wicked and lazy servant, you knew that I reap where I have not sown and gather where I have not scattered seed. You who ought to have deposited my money with the bankers, and at my coming I would have received back my own with interest. So take the talent from him and give it to him who has 10 talents. For everyone who has, more will be given, and he who has will have abundance, but from him who does not have, even what he has will be taken away. And cast the unprofitable servant into the outer darkness. There will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. And there you have wicked and lazy. He's not two terms that probably anybody you know has ever put together in a sentence and called anybody today that you've heard. Certainly I haven't. Brian, you stole my thunder with that lady you met.
Oh, sorry.
No, that's great. Because I mean that's exactly the point, that all these verses, it reminded me of somebody that I cared deeply for, who was caught up in a destructive lifestyle, and then in a moment had endangered their life physically. And I'm reminded of the fear that we felt, that they could have died, when the reality was that spiritually and morally and psychologically and emotionally, a corrosiveness had eaten away at their life for a good while. So, you know, true, their heart was beating and pumping blood through their veins, keeping the mechanics of their body operating, but much of everything else was in a state of advanced decay, dead even. And relationships, the very fuel of life, had broken down beyond repair. There was a loss of an ability to appreciate, to love, to be loved, to communicate, and to commune. They were a spiritual quadriplegic, a much worse condition than any physical handicap. But if it is that laziness, so it is true that that laziness and wickedness is associated with a type of death. Then the opposite must be true as well, that diligence and righteousness could be associated with life, a vibrant life. Proverbs 13:4, the soul of the sluggard craves and gets nothing, while the soul of the diligent is richly supplied. Often people who struggle with an addiction are put on a strict work schedule and routine. One very important aspect of treating depression is exercise. There's something about getting one's heart racing and being physically vigorously active that works as a stimulant for breaking out of a rut and an antidote to negative emotions and thought. I think it comes across in the Bible that God is holistic about our being, that we need to take care of every aspect of who we are, and we can't be so simplistic on one hand and try to be so mechanical and so about having such strict dichotomy of of what's what is psychological and what's emotional. God wants us to love Him with our everything, with our b'chol me'odecha, and that's our whole being. And that's what life is. It's not a matter of about being clinically alive. That's not life. Just because we have blood pumping through our veins, life is righteousness. It's being fully immersed in Him. That's it.
I had a question. I wonder if denial is a form of laziness. I was thinking, because of tomorrow's date, I was thinking of the denial in the West, particularly in the United States, the denial that there's a danger from Islamicism or from, that there's people out there trying to impose Sharia law on the rest of the world. And,
yeah.
There is a danger of, like the sluggard, of just sitting around and then the destruction comes.
Right.
Sort of like the Fort Hood thing.
Right.
Everybody's just sitting around. Listens to websites. It's right. Like, oh, that's religious.
Right.
People listen to religious stuff.
Right.
And then it happens, and they go, oh, and then they write a report, and they say, well, he was troubled.
Right.
Obviously, he was troubled because he did something that we would all disagree with. And, is that... It is a kind of mental laziness.
Yeah.
It's also maybe related to fear or related to not wanting... being afraid of where something would lead.
Right.
In any case, I'm not sure exactly if it's laziness. There's a mental laxity, but as you were talking, I was just thinking, there's a lot of parallels here with some stuff that's related. But
there's a struggle, and they know it's not a clean fight, and they're just wanting to avoid it.
And they're just wanting to avoid it.
Yeah.
And so it's a kind of laziness.
So they don't want to be tainted with... They'll be tainted with...
They don't want to take a side because then they would be required to work.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, you'll see some of it tomorrow between the lines.
Yeah, definitely. Okay.
Okay.